One thing that surprised me, and I'm not sure how to make sense of myself yet, is the extent to which faith guides a lot of parenting practices. And so, for some people who talked about their religious beliefs, they did so in a way that I would say I would assess as depoliticizing what they're doing, rooting something in a value system that is inherently like logical and truthful, felt like a way of separating values from politics. And I mean, you're trained in sociology, so am I. So we think about all of these things as a political context. But I think for a lot of people, the language of social movements, social issues, and social justice is something that happens out there on the front lines. And parenting is something that happens in the home and on the inside. It's more private, and it's less directly related to like, movements in a really classical sense. Whereas what I'm interested in writing about is how deeply intertwined these things are. So it was a bit fascinating for me to see parents like really not thinking about the relationship between those two things, but they are navigating that relationship every single day. So if they have a belief system about gender, for example, about, say, the stability of gender or the gender binary, they are then encountering different lessons as their kids attend public school and, like a different kind of discourse, and have to figure out what they're going to say and make meaning of that. So those are some of the most interesting conversations to me, parents saying like things about their value system, what they're afraid to say publicly in the context of the school, for fear of their kids being stigmatized or for them being written off as bigoted, but still wanting to instill what they feel is like really important culturally for them, while their kids inherit new language through the curriculum. That's been like a real delight, and also really scary. Like, I don't know how to make sense of this.
It's fascinating. It sounds very complicated.
Yeah.
It makes me think, like we mentioned throughout this that, parenting is very, it's very socially embedded, and there is a lot of role, or sorry, a lot of pressure within the role of the parent to act in a way that is considered like morally good or driven by a correctly kind of aligned set of morals, depending on who you are and the cultural context that you've kind of come up in. And yeah, there's immense pressure to be a quote unquote good parent. How is that meant? And we've talked about it a little bit already, but how has that manifested in the work that you've been doing?
I would have expected more discussion of this in interviews. What I'm finding is less a story of parents driven by a moral obligation or a sense of duty, although they are expressing a sense of duty. The story that I'm hearing from parents is less about striving to be good parents in particular ways, and is more about having a lot of information about what benefits kids. And so I'm really fascinated by the way in which parents of this generation, like one common theme in interviews has been, if people are a little tight and we're warming up still in the interview, if I ask a question like, well, some of us, like on the sidelines of a soccer field, express like not wanting to parent the way we were parented. Almost across the board, people are like, "Oh yeah, that's definitely true." So there are like sort of like there is like a strong moral sense among parents about like a better way or a good way. But I'm not getting the story that I expected, which is more about like a kind of anxiety about being good as a parent. It's more a story of, okay, so I know that there are retro styles of parenting, or there are like cultural norms around parenting from the 70s or 80s or 90s. And a lot of parents here were parented somewhere else, right? Like overseas somewhere, or outside of Metro Vancouver, and their kids are all kind of coming together. They're all exchanging these values and encountering them in exciting ways. But parents have a lot of information. So they have like, we have, psychologists and parenting experts on social media just streaming content right into our coffee breaks. mental health things, like best ways to teach your kids math or how to get your kids to eat different colors of vegetables or whatever. So it's been more a story of parsing that information, not getting overwhelmed by that information. And I think like the critique of this would be like the critique that I have is, well, now we have a lot of information. Through which to moralize parenting and to download responsibilities from the state to parents and in particular mothers when it comes to raising healthy and ethical citizens. But I think the flip side is that information about how to be kind to children and how to like honor their emotional needs and their sensitivities and how to take children seriously in a way that culturally was not as important a few decades ago is a really wonderful thing. And I've benefited hugely from the resources I can access. The moral question is a good one. And I think that that will drive whatever writing comes of this.
Yeah, it's something that I would expect is, like you mentioned, would expect it to be a little more central, but also maybe more subtextual, kind of something that just happens under
exactly.
the surface. Yeah. I'm curious, you've mentioned a few times the kind of the gendered aspect of parenting and the particular pressure that's put on mothers. Have you mostly been speaking to people in mothering roles through your work?
Mostly. I don't have the exact numbers, but I think it's something around, I think it's around 80%, both in survey respondents and interviews. We maybe have interviewed slightly more men, people who identify as men, than 20%, because when we were first looking at the 280 people who signed up to be interviewed, I thought maybe in interviews I should try to diversify the sample a little bit more than the questionnaire. But again, people then who respond to my question to be interviewed kind of determine that. So yeah, it's been a lot of people, a lot of mothers. And so I'm getting a lot of information about a story that we know really well in the research about divisions of labor. Although again, like some interviews have been a lot about, or not a lot, but they have mentioned a sort of gender division of labor, but I'm seeing more activity and more like divide and conquer mindset in families and working families in Metro Vancouver that I think speaks directly to the economic situation in an expensive market. So I would say the majority of parents, even though mothers who I have interviewed, readily talk about the emotional management labor that they do more of in the home, people are just doing the most with what they have. And so I actually think somewhat optimistically and cynically that we'll see gender divisions of labor shift out of necessity.
It's an interesting thing to be kind of observing as you work through your project. I know from being in classes with you and like being able to read the things that you've developed into your syllabus that like gender divisions of labor are an area of interest in your work. And it must be really fascinating to kind of watch these things shift as you do your own research.
It's bizarre.
It's really cool.
It is cool.
I guess I have one more question that's really related to the research itself. And it's something that you've kind of touched on across our conversation today. But when you started, you were looking specifically at the kind of social movements and issues that were arising around kind of early pandemic years, like 2020 to 2022, 2021 kind of area. But, you know, you're doing your interviews now and things have more social movements have started to bubble up. Things have shifted. There are different areas of focus. For example, there's a lot of focus on things like SOGI education, sexual orientation, gender identity education in schools, as kind of contentious areas for parents. Have you seen these movements, these like social shifts kind of blending together in your work? And are they, I'm just curious how they're showing up, I guess.
I think this is something that has surprised me. And if I were to go back to the drawing board, and like probably what I will kind of in an iterative way incorporate into my questions as I continue to interview people, is the extent to which a lot of social, what you and I might call social issues or social movement discourse, is entering homes through BC curriculum. And I didn't anticipate this as much. I mean, this is one of my questions. So I did expect that, you know, parents are seeing the newsletter home from the school about Orange Shirt Day or about Red Shirt Day or Pink Shirt Day. And you know, kid art is centered around different cultures and like different histories. And so I did expect that things would be different from, I mean, I grew up in BC, so did you. So we have like a knowledge of the BC curriculum, but especially around like the sexual and gender education and anti-racist education, but more so around sexuality and gender identity, I would say, that has politicized parents. And I didn't even know what SOGI stood for when I started these interviews. I think probably because my kids are just entering school age. So I haven't been as, I've just seen sort of like the media representation of like parent groups versus school boards and anti-oppression working groups. And so pandemic era versus sort of this political climate for social justice education, I actually don't think that we can distinguish them, but I certainly anticipated more people talking about the stress of parenting through a pandemic. People are done talking about that. So people are talking about their confusion as parents around how to talk to their kids about gender and sexuality. A lot of parents find it pretty clear how to talk to them about consent, which is cool. I don't think that that was something that 20 years ago they would have talked about. But they're just like a lot of questions because I think the language is changing. And so a lot of parents spoke to, I think, what I would call like a more general societal anxiety around fear of saying the wrong thing. So there, I think that a lot of like students are finding this in their fieldwork as well on totally different topics. We have a kind of socially anxious climate around language and a lot of discomfort. And I think I'm interested in capturing this for parents because they're trying to do this essential work, you know, of just like raising kids. It's very basic. It's actually not that exceptional at all, right? It's just like such a natural thing. But the words in their mouths from their own childhoods and from modeling aren't the ones that they're trying to use. And so what is this experience?
It's absolutely fascinating. And I'm so excited to see this research develop. And I'm very excited to read things when they are published.
Thank you.
I'm curious, what is your hope for your research into this area? Is there a direction that you want it to go? Is it something you want to build on in the future?
Oh, I'm in the weeds of fieldwork, so that's a tough one. Ultimately, I think where I want my career research to be going is showing people to themselves in ways that help them feel more connected to each other. Like, I think that we have this major problem of political polarization and the atomization of households, and austerity and precarity, you know, doesn't help. So what we need is solidarity and community, and those muscles are atrophied in my generation. And so I think that in a small way, I'm hoping that research into parenting helps create empathy between parents in ways that help us turn toward each other. And so this is a tricky thing I'm navigating right now as I communicate early findings back to parents, because people are politically, you know, it's a really diverse group. But if parents can see each other as in mutual struggle in some ways, I think that might just erode that kind of defensiveness one iota, and that would be a happy moment for me.
Thank you. Yeah, I can understand that completely. It is a powerful thing to be able to create solidarity and for people to be able to see a common experience is very powerful.
We need it, I guess. And I need it too. I think I always try to explain things that I don't yet understand how to do. So I think this is a life project.
Is there anything that we haven't touched on in our conversation today that you feel is an important piece of the conversation that needs to be added before we come to a close?
I know these questions have been like totally unexpected and really a nice way for me to start to crystallize some things from the research. I guess just as you were asking them, I was thinking like how hard parents are working and to make ends meet, and you know, how much kind of stress they just kind of roll with, and how impressed I am by parents in a way that like I just did not expect. So I've just been really grateful to the participants for sharing their time and really getting deep and honest with some of those like tricky fears and values things that are hard to say out loud in a time where you feel like you'll be judged. And so I'm just really appreciating that about the research through your question. So I'm really grateful. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing. I really appreciate talking with you and learning more about what you're doing. Yeah, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Bird note. Peer into the world of birds, and eyes of many different colors peer back. There are shades of light and dark, yellows, whites, greens, the red eyes of certain hawks, ducks, loons, herons, and songbirds. These colors really pop because birds have no white around the iris like we do. So the yellow eyes of a great horned owl or a herring gull seem to give the birds a fierce, penetrating glare. While eye color isn't tied to one group of birds or another, a pattern common to many birds is a change in eye color as immature birds grow to adulthood. Bald eagles, ring-billed gulls, ducks such as Goldeneye and Scalp have brown eyes as youngsters and yellow as adults. Red-tailed hawks reverse this pattern, with their eyes changing from yellow to brown, while the yellow eyes of a young Cooper's hawk turn deep red as it reaches maturity. Not all birds' eyes change color as the birds age. But for those whose eye color appears to signal adulthood, this is likely an adaptation that helps them gauge the maturity and suitability of potential mates. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann. BirdNote gives you the sounds of birds every day, and you get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram at BirdNote Radio.
Welcome back to the open. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam First Peoples. I almost introduced the wrong show there. I don't know if you all caught that, but it's 10 a.m., almost 11 a.m. I'm tired, and I hope you can forgive me. I really hope that you enjoy that conversation that I had with Dr. Amanda Watson about her work into parenting in this current time and place and the unique experiences of parents in our modern era. Amanda Watson is a fantastic academic at SFU. And as I mentioned before, if you are interested in learning more about her and her work, her SFU faculty page is the best place to go. You can take a look at what she is currently researching, as well as her previous publications, which include her book, which she released in 2020, which is called The Juggling Mother, Coming Undone in the Age of Anxiety. Something that really stuck out for me in that conversation, which was somewhat unexpected on my end, especially someone who early on, as Amanda mentioned in our conversation, I had worked with Amanda and some other research assistants on this project, on the preliminary stages of this project. But I was surprised that there was an aspect of depoliticization amongst parents around their parenting practices and their experiences of parenting in a kind of tumultuous world. I do believe that I think my perspective on the world and the ways that I personally have experienced it and the ways that I look at it on a daily basis have been drastically impacted by my experience within the field of sociology. And that's something that Amanda did call attention to in our discussion. And I find it interesting that it's the inherent politicality of our identities and our experiences is not always at the immediate forefront for everyone. But that doesn't mean that it is not a concern or that it's not being thought about. It's just not always being thought about with those words attached to it. But I do believe that many of us are aware in some way or another that, you know, as the feminist adage goes, the personal is political. There is a political aspect to even the most private aspects of our lives. We are constantly, as beings, as human beings, engaging in a society, engaging with each other. Our identities and our experiences are constantly in conversation with systems of power and different social institutions. And I think that knowledge of that, whether it is a subtextual or a very overt knowledge, is really, really valuable to understanding our experiences and the ways that we can connect with each other. A point that Amanda really brought to the forefront at the end of our discussion was that building solidarity amongst parents of different experiences in terms of understanding where experience is shared and where common struggle is shared can be a really powerful tool. And I think from my own personal perspective as a young person looking at this research and looking at this kind of phenomenon, I think when we recognize the politicality of our own identities, we can develop a knowledge of how we share experience and where we can support each other. Anyways, rambling a little bit on my own opinion there, but I really hope that this conversation was
of value to anyone listening, and I hope that you're able to carry it forward with you into your day and maybe share some thoughts with other people as you go through your week. I actually forgot to tell you all about the song we just heard before we returned to my ramblings here. We heard a track called After All by Alex G. That's off his most recent album, God Save the Animals. This is the end of the show here on Speak Up at CJSF 90.1 FM. Please stay tuned. We've got Democracy Now! Coming up next. And I am going to give us one more song to kind of play us out of the day, or play us out of this segment of the day. We have a track by a local group, Apollo Ghosts. This is Morning Voice. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope you're having a wonderful, wonderful morning, and I look forward to speaking with you again.
Trails that blaze across my head. Father left me in the leaves, gentle boughs of cedar branches on the beach. Eyes are black and seafoam green. Oh, life's funny, and she's always been waiting, waiting.
To the Rock and Blues Show, broadcasting 2 hours of the best in rock and blues music every Thursday morning from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. at CJSF 90.1 FM. From Albert King to ZZ Top, we delve into almost 90 years of recorded blues music, featuring big guitars, powerful vocals, and driving rhythms. From the Mississippi Delta to the Great White North, across two oceans and two hemispheres, we play the music that gave birth to almost all modern music. As Muddy Waters said, the blues had a baby, and they named it rock and roll. I hope you'll tune in to CJSF 90.1 FM Thursday mornings from 7 to 9 for a music experience unlike any other.
Are you inspired? Do you want to be? Tune in to The Arts Edge with Annie Roach, Saturdays from 6 to 7 p.m. and hear stories of artists and educators, writers, painters, actors, people from all walks of life. Hear how people are making their lives happen. You can find us at CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby Mountain. We're at TELUS HD Channel 7014, or you can find us on the internet at www.cjsf.ca. Tune in to The Arts Edge